Okay, we're in 2 Samuel chapter 13. Our most recent history in this book has been a summation or a manifestation of David sort of riding a wave of blessing, divine blessing in his life. He has been brought from a job as a shepherd in his mid to late teens to actually king of Israel at this point in time, and he's reigning over all of the territory that you see here in the blue, whether it's hashed or solid, either one doesn't matter. He's reigning over all of that. He's now captured or won some of the territories to the south and north and east of what he had originally, and so things are looking quite good for him. He has been blessed by God mightily and was enjoying the fruits of those blessings, kind of taking it easy, so to speak. And unfortunately, that might be a time that he wished he had been a little busier, because it was during that time, sort of a time of ease, after things had sort of settled down in the kingdom, that he had this encounter with Bathsheba. And we saw the detail of that last week, if you recall. It was splish splash, she was taking a bath, but in the wrong place. And we just touched upon very briefly the possibility that maybe she was somewhat complicit in this whole thing. I don't know. But it's a little bit striking that knowing that you have an unobstructed line of sight from the king's palace down to your backyard, you would think maybe you would take a bath inside. But she took one outside, and unfortunately for both her and David, he saw her. And he couldn't leave it alone. He couldn't let it go at that. He actually followed the initial lust that he had for her and went and sought her out and brought her into his palace. And he lay with her and, in essence, committed adultery with her, and she was, of course, a married woman. That in turn led to his lying and trying to deceive her husband Uriah, and he ultimately committed murder by having Uriah placed in a position in a battle that almost assured his death, and indeed did cause his death. And so he basically committed murder as a end result of the lust that began when he first saw Bathsheba. Now remember, he has other wives at this time. Six other ones that we know of that he will actually touch. One more that maybe he will or won't, we don't know, about Micah. Michal, I think is maybe how her name is pronounced. I don't know. Probably got it wrong there. But at any rate, he had wives, and he did not have to proceed down the path that he did to create this adulterous, lying, deceitful, murderous relationship with Bathsheba. But nevertheless, he did. And the whole thing was very displeasing to God, as the scriptures say. God knew about it, of course, but the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. So he may be thinking he's getting away with it, but he's not. So the Lord sent somebody to him to confront him with his sin, the prophet Nathan. And Nathan's In order to communicate the Lord's message to David, used a little storyline about a guy who had one pet lamb to his name, very fond of that lamb, treated it like a child, one of his family members. And a very wealthy individual who had lots of lambs lived nearby, and when someone came to visit the wealthy individual took the one lamb from the poor guy who had the only one, and used it in sacrifice and food for his guests. And of course, in that story, David is the rich guy. Uriah is the poor guy with the one lamb, and the lamb is Bathsheba. And so when Nathan related that story to David, David said, well, that no good so-and-so. He's going to pay fourfold for that, for taking that guy's one little lamb. Good thing for him he didn't say tenfold. Because the fourfold payment that he's going to make for that lamb is his own son's. He's going to lose four of his own sons in restitution for this sin. In verse 6 of chapter 12, David said, and he must make restitution for the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and had no compassion. That no good so-and-so. And Nathan says, David, you're that man. You're that no good so-and-so that you just talked about. You're the guy that's going to make fourfold restitution for taking Bathsheba from Uriah. And on top of that, I'm going to, in essence, put conflict into your family. The sword is not going to be removed from your family for the rest of your life. From the rest of David's days, which is about another 20 years or more, he's going to have nothing but conflict in his family. He's going to lose four sons to pay back, by his own testimony, his offense here in this matter. So he ain't getting away with anything like he thought he was. Adultery, lying, murder, it does not escape God's notice, and David is going to pay for that dearly. First payment was that was the child born to David and Bathsheba. We don't have a name, but it was a male child. And you remember, God struck the child with an illness. It lingered for 7 days and then it died. So the first installment of that fourfold payment that David's going to have to make was his first child born to him and Bathsheba. And that child died. There was a second child born to him and Bathsheba. What was his name? Yeah, that was Solomon, or Jedediah. God named him Jedediah. David named him Solomon. He'll be okay, as will some others. But there's still three more of David's children that are going to die because of this sin. And we'll see them as the story rolls on along here. And it rolls on along right into that theme here in chapter 13. So let's pick up there. Now, it was after this that Absalom, remember, his mother was Maacah, M-A-A-C-A-H. I don't know exactly how that's pronounced, but something like that. The son of David had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. So this is another one of David's sons, Absalom, and his daughter, Tamar, by Maacah. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Whoops. Another one of her brothers, Amnon, had a lust affair with his stepsister, Tamar. Different mothers, same father. Okay, they're half siblings. So Absalom and Tamar are from the mother Maacah, and Amnon was from Ahinoam. He's actually David's firstborn. So you see what's going on here? You got these two siblings from one mother, and you got this guy from another mother. He is lusting after his stepsister, or his half-sister, Tamar. Got the picture? Okay. Now, God said he was going to put a sword in his family that was never going to leave it. So, these kinds of things are going to happen to him. Says he loved her. We'll see whether that holds up or not. And Amnon was frustrated because of his sister Tamar, that he so much so that he made himself ill. For she was a virgin, and it seemed hard to Amnon to do anything to her. Can you believe this guy? He is lusting after her so much so, she's a virgin, that he's sick because he can't do anything about it. He can't have her for a wife, or so he thinks, and so he's just sick over it. This thing is a festering situation that is not good. And by the way, Leviticus 18:11 says you don't even mess with your full sister or half sister, either one. Strictly forbidden in the Mosaic Law. But Amnon has a friend, and that word probably ought to be in quotations. His name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. So another nephew, niece, second cousin, twice removed, or some nonsense like that. And Jonadab was a very shrewd man. This guy's a sneaky rat, in other words, is what he is. And so he says to him, that is to Amnon, O son of the king, why are you so depressed morning after morning? Will you not tell me? Then Amnon said to him, I am in love with Tamar, the sister of my brother Absalom. So he admits to this guy that he's got this love affair going on with his stepsister. Well, so Jonadab comes up with a plan, and he says to him, well, lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. So this guy's plan is based upon deceit. He tells Amnon to act like he is ill, pretend to be ill. So right off the bat, we might have suspicions that this plan may not turn out real good, right? Since it's based upon more lying and deceit in this family. David's family is going south in a hurry at this point. So he tells him, well, act like you're sick, and when your father comes to see you, say to him, well, please let my sister Tamar come and give me some food to eat, and let her prepare the food in my sight that I may see it and eat from her hand. So the only way he thinks he can get her anywhere near him physically is to act like he's sick, ask permission from David that she come and cook something for him in his sickly state, and David would probably allow it under those circumstances. Otherwise, she would probably never get anywhere near this guy's quarters. And so he does. He lays down and pretended to be ill, and when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, please let my sister Tamar come and make me a couple of cakes in my sight that I may eat from her hand. So then David sent to the house for Tamar, saying, go now to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him. Now David had been insightful enough in many circumstances that you'd think maybe he would start to smell a rat here. But he doesn't, and he does go along with it. So she goes to her brother Amnon's house, and he was lying down, and she took dough, kneaded it, made cakes in his sight, and baked the cakes. Now, the very fact that this guy wanted her in his place ought to have maybe pricked up David's suspicions a little bit, because if he just wanted something to eat that she's good at cooking, just fix it and take it to him. Let somebody else take it to him. The fact that he wants her there ought to alert him a little bit that something isn't quite right. So she took the pan and dished him out before him, but he refused to eat, and Amnon said, have everyone go out from me. So everyone went out from him. There's another red flag that he wants to be alone with her in his place. So then Amnon said to Tamar, bring me the food into the bedroom. And that ain't a red flag, man. That is a screaming neon flashing sign. She should have headed for the door right then and there. So Tamar took the cakes which she had made and brought them to the bedroom to her brother Amnon. And when she brought them to him to eat, he took hold of her and said, come lie with me, my sister. So the plan is working as far as he's concerned. He's got her alone in his bedroom, and he grabs her. But she answered him, said, no, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing. So she recognizes what's about to happen here and pleads for a little decency on the part of this guy, reminding him that what he's about to do is despicable among this people and a total disgrace to the entire family. And going on, she says, as for me, where could I get rid of my reproach? How is this going to leave her? If he rapes her, where does that leave her? She's not going to be married again. No one's going to want her. He's basically flushing her life down the drain for his own selfish lusts. And she sees that. She sees that train coming. And as for you, you know, not only is going to leave her totally destroyed, as for you, you'll be like one of the fools in Israel. He's going to make a total fool out of himself. Now, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. She suggests as an alternative, if he wants her, ask for her hand in marriage from David. He ain't going to get it. David is not going to give his daughter to one of his sons. That ain't going to happen. But she's desperate. She's grasping at any straw she could come up with here. And so she suggests to him that there is at least a semi-decent way of going about this. He would not listen to her, however, verse 14. Since he was stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. And is that not usually the problem? Most women are not as strong as most men. Most women can be overpowered physically by most men. Not everyone, of course. Some women can beat the daylights out of a lot of men. But mostly the men have the advantage of strength, and so he just simply rapes her. He overpowers her, his own stepsister, and violated her. Well, that should have satisfied him and everything be fine, right? Of course not. Then Amnon hated her with a very great hatred. Well, I thought he loved her earlier. There ain't no love involved in this whole thing. This is lust. There is no love involved. If he loved her, he would do nothing to disgrace or harm her. Clearly, he does not love her. He lusts after her, and he's willing to satisfy his own lust at her at the expense of the rest of her life. What a scumbag this guy is. This is David's firstborn, by the way. This is the first heir to the kingdom, in theory. And the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her, of course, because it wasn't love, it was lust. So Amnon said to her, "Get up, go away." He throws her out after raping her. And she pleads again, verse 16, "No, because this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other that you have done to me." Yet he would not listen to her. He could have taken her in and married her, and she'd have some semblance of a life. But no, he just throws her out like some sort of a used vessel of some kind and tells her to get out. Then he called his young man who attended him and said, "Throw this woman out of my presence and lock the door behind her." That sounds like love at work, doesn't it? Doesn't even call her by name. "Throw this woman out of here and lock her out." This guy is not only a rapist, he is an insultingly mean one as well. Now, she had on a long sleeve garment, for this is the manner virgin daughters of the king dress themselves in robes. Then the attendant took her out and locked the door behind her. The virgin girls would dress in a certain way that they were recognizable as that. So she's got on clothing that marked her when she came in as a virgin. But they threw her out. And Tamar put ashes on her head and tore her long sleeve garment, which was on her. That was a sign, of course, of being violated. And she put her hand on her head and went away crying aloud as she went. So she is now displaying the situation in her behavior of what has just transpired. She is no longer a virgin. She is mourning because of what has happened here. So he rapes his stepsister and then throws her out immediately. This is Amnon who did this. Then Absalom, her brother, said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you?" He probably had some suspicions himself, so he knows what's going on right away. He suspects it was his own stepbrother who did this instead of some stranger or somebody else who could have perhaps gotten to her. And he says, "But now keep silent, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this matter to heart." So Tamar remained and was desolate in her brother Absalom's house. So she lives now with her brother in his house because she can't go anywhere else. She has no chance for a husband. She has just simply been, in essence, ruined by this Amnon. And her real brother, her blood brother, knows it. So he says, "Okay, for now, bide your time." He's going to take care of this little matter himself. But for now, he said, "Don't go making a big deal out of it. You just stay here and live in my house." Now, when King David heard of all these matters, he was very angry. So what did he do about it? He didn't do squat. He didn't do anything. Why doesn't he take proper vengeance on behalf of his daughter against this son? Well, he's the firstborn, remember? Firstborn supposed heir to the kingdom. And it looks like he just simply wimped out. He did not do what he should have done. He should have made justice prevail. Actually, the kid should have been stoned. But he did nothing. He just got mad. Is this the same guy we saw planting a rock between Goliath's eyes? No, or defeating the Philistines every time he went out against them? The character we're seeing displayed in David at this point in time is significantly different than what we've seen before. At times we've seen him at the crest of the wave, and now we're seeing him at the trough. He's back to one of these low spots again. He's not doing anything about this. He let this go on in his family. But Absalom, the brother, did not speak to Amnon, either good or bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. So now, in addition to lustful raping and lying and deceiving and all that going on in the family, we got hatred building up between brothers with the same father. God said, "I'm going to put a sword in your family and it ain't ever going to leave." And here it is. So Absalom bided his time and didn't do anything just then, but he has a good memory. He's going to do something about it later. He just didn't do anything about it that day. So it came about after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shears in Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. Absalom bit his tongue for 2 years. Then he's come up with this plan. They're going to have sort of this festive occasion that is associated with shearing of sheep. Usually that was kind of like a, maybe like a barn raising used to be in our early pioneer days, where everybody would come and get together and do this thing, and they'd all eat and have a big time together, sort of a celebration and some work mixed together. And so Absalom says, he came and asked David for permission. He says, "Behold now, your servant has sheep shears. That is, we're going to have this big deal going on down here. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant." David probably wouldn't be going himself, but he could have others go. He could let the others go if he wanted to. But the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, we should not all go, lest we be burdensome to you." Although he urged him, he would not go, but blessed him. So David's first response is, "No, let's don't let all the family go down there and join with you. That's too big of a deal for you to have to manage. So we'd just be a burden to you. So thanks, but no thanks." Then Absalom said, "Well, if not, please let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said to him, "Why do you want him to go with you?" Now, he knew about the situation here, as we're told there in verse 21. 2 years have passed, and memory's dulled a little bit, but he might again been thinking a little bit about, "Now, wait a minute, this is the brother that raped your sister, and you want him to go?" Again, these red flags are kind of being waved in David's face, and he's not picking up on them very well. And so when Absalom urged him, he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. So he said, "All right, I'm not going to go, but all the other guys can go. You can take them all down there, and you guys can have a good old time." And Absalom commanded his servant, saying, "See now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then put him to death. Do not fear, have I not myself commanded you? Be courageous and valiant." And the servants of Absalom did to Amnon just as Absalom had commanded. They killed the guy. Number two son is now gone in payment of the fourfold restitution, remember? First son was the infant that we don't know his name. Second son is his number one son, Amnon, the rapist of his daughter, Tamar. He's now dead. Two payments out of the fourfold payment have now been made by David's dead sons. Then all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. I don't know why they ride mules. You'd think he'd ride horses. Could be a donkey. A mule is, you know, a mule's a little bigger, a little stronger than a horse. I can understand mules being used for a lot of things, but I don't know why you'd want to ride one for transportation. They're kind of slow and not so real good at that. But at any rate, they got mules. They all hopped on their mules. They jumped in their limos and left. Now, while they were on their way, the report came to David saying, "Absalom has struck down all the king's sons, and not one of them is left." He probably got that report off of CNN. That report is so wrong that it's ridiculous. They didn't all get killed. He didn't strike them all down. Just Amnon. But here's the story when it gets back to David. It's all wrong. So he arose, tore his clothes, and hit the ground. And all his servants were standing by with clothes torn. So everybody goes into an immediate state of mourning, thinking that all of these sons are dead. Then Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, this is the guy with the good plan to start with, remember? This wise brother, or a very shrewd man. He comes and tells David, wait a minute. "Don't let my lord suppose that they put to death all the young men. The king's sons, for Amnon's dead is Amnon alone is dead, because by the intent of Absalom, this has been determined since the day that he violated his sister Tamar." In other words, Absalom had this in mind for 2 years, how he's going to kill off this worthless stepbrother of his. "So now, therefore, do not let my lord the king take the report to heart, namely, all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead." So this guy corrects the report that is only the one son that has now been killed. And Absalom fled. And the young man who was the watchman raised his eyes and looked, and behold, many people were coming from the road behind him by the side of the mountain. Apparently, the entourage is coming back to Jerusalem. And Jonadab said to the king, Behold, the king's sons have come according to your servant's word. So it happened. Hey, just like I told you, David, here they come. They're all out here. And it came about as soon as he had finished speaking that, behold, the king's sons came and lifted their voices and wept, and also the king and all his servants wept very bitterly. So the whole thing is still a tragedy, to be sure, but not as bad as it was originally reported. Still, he's lost one of his sons in a vengeful act by another one of his sons. And Absalom is the one taking revenge. Now, Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, the king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the heart of David longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. Now, Absalom now hooks him, and he goes and lives over here. This place is up here that they're talking about on this map. And he's there now for 3 years. Now, David finally got over the grief and anger perhaps associated with this, and he was comforted concerning his dead son, Amnon, after that 3 years. So now we got the family all broken up. We got it being fractured because of these murderous, rapists, deceitful acts, and it's starting to fragment a little bit. The heir apparent to the throne is now dead. Absalom is living over up on the east side of the Jordan there, up in this area up here. And 3 years have transpired. Installment number 2 of David's own pronouncement has been made. His second son is dead. 2 more of them will be dead before this story is completely over. Actually, when you get in, got to get into Solomon's reign to get to the last one, but the third one will be taken care of here. Okay, so what was a very rosy and delightful picture of the life of David and the progress he had made in his walk before God up until Bathsheba needed a bath has now turned south badly. Look what's going on in his family. Children killing each other, raping each other, lying, deceiving each other. I mean, this is a total disastrous family that God said he was going to bring about because of David's sin. Did he get away with anything? Did killing, you know, Uriah looked like he was the only one that didn't know what was going on. He carries his own death warrant to Joab, but everybody else seems to know. And he is paying a severe, severe price for this affair with Bathsheba. Okay, 3 years go by. Now, Joab, you remember who Joab is? He's the head of David's army. He's kind of the David's Abner type. Saul's Abner is Joab for David, head of the army, his nephew. Zeruiah was David's sister, so Joab is the son of David's sister, or his nephew, in other words. He's ahead of David's army. He perceived that the king's heart was inclined toward Absalom. So Joab picks up on the fact that David now has sort of gotten over this thing a little bit and is missing his son Absalom. This Joab, he's kind of going to step in the deal here, kind of like matchmaking, you know. He's going to help try to solve the problem. So he sent to Tekoa, that's a town about 5 or 10 miles south of Jerusalem, and brought a wise woman from there and said to her, I was going to make some bad jokes about wise woman. I was going to say that's an oxymoron, but I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that. But I was thinking it. I'm just not going to say it. He goes and gets this wise woman, and she is pretty wise. We'll see. And he's going to use her now in this plot to try to restore David and Absalom. He says, look, here's what I want you to do. Please pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments now. You know, act the role out with your proper dress. And do not anoint yourself with oil. Look like you're mourning, in other words. Look a little rough around the edges because you're going to pretend that you're mourning. And pretend that you've been mourning now for the dead for many days. Then go into the king and speak to him in this manner. And so Joab put the words in her mouth. So she's going to go and confront David and appear to him to be someone that is in mourning over some family situation that she wants to talk to him about. So, got the scene? He kind of hired him a professional actress here, it looks like, to go work this out. So the woman goes into the king, and she fell on her face to the ground and prostrated herself and said, "Help, O king." And the king said to her, "What is your trouble?" And she answered, and here's the story. "Truly, I am a widow, for my husband is dead. And your maidservant had two sons, but the two of them struggled together in the field, and there was no one to separate them, so one struck the other and killed him. So she's now left with only one son," is the storyline. "Now behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant, and they said, 'Hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. And they will extinguish my coal which is left.'" This would be a reference to having an heir. If he's sort of like the last ember in the fire. And if he goes out, there's no heir left for her. So she says, "The rest of the family want to take revenge on him, and that will leave me with no one, so as to leave my husband neither name nor remnant in the face of the earth." So the story is as she says there. Look, I'm about to lose my only heir here. I want to be reunited with him, but everybody wants to kill him off. So she's setting a stage, a storyline that is similar to the relationship between David and Absalom. You see the picture here? Kind of like what Nathan did. Nathan put him right in the middle of a story, and he stepped all over it in it on himself by predicting a fourfold vengeance, killed four of his sons. So she's got the story set. So then David responds to her in verse 8, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you." It looks like in verse 8 he's kind of trying to blow her off. Kind of say, "Well, going back home, I'll figure out something. I'll send orders to you." It's kind of like, "I don't want to deal with this now. Go away." But the woman said to the king, "O my lord, the king, the inquiry is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless." This is my personal problem. So the king says, "Well, whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you anymore." If anybody brings any sort of retaliation against her, David said, "I will step in and take care of this for you. No one's going to bother you." So she says, "Well, please let the king remember the Lord your God, so that the avenger of blood may not continue to destroy, lest they destroy my son." And he said, "As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. One hair of his head shall fall to the ground." She's referring back to the right of heirs to take vengeance on a murder or something like that against a family member. You could run to these cities of refuge, but if you didn't do that, the next family member of kin could take revenge on you. And she's afraid that's going to happen. And David assures her, he's not going to let that happen. So then the woman said, "Well, please let your maidservant speak a word to my lord, the king." And he said, "Speak." She says, "Can I talk to you sort of off the record?" He says, "Sure." So the woman said, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is one who is guilty." In other words, this is equivalent to Nathan saying, "You are the man here, David. And that the king does not bring back the banished one." He's doing to his son Absalom what her storyline presented to him as a great offense before. He said, "I'm not going to let that happen." And she goes on to say, "For we shall surely die and are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again, inevitability of dying. Yet God does not take away life, but plans it so that the banished one may not be cast out from him." So she, again, is appealing to David to restore Absalom. "Now the reason I have come to speak this word to my lord the king is because the people have made me afraid. So your maidservant said, 'Let me now speak to the king. Perhaps the king will perform the request for his maidservant. For the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy both me and my son from the inheritance of God.' Then your maidservant said, 'Please let the word of my lord the king be comforting for the angel, for as the angel of God, so is my lord the king to discern good and evil.'" In other words, she thinks David is, he can see and understand these situations, kind of like Solomon will do after him, but he'll understand what's going on here. "And may the Lord your God be with you." So in hearing this now, David kind of catches on what's going on here. He says, "Hey, don't hide anything from me that I'm about to ask you." And she said, "Let my lord the king please speak." So the king said, "Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?" Remember whose plot this was? See, David now recognizes that this is an attempt on the part of Joab to get him and Absalom back together. Joab is matchmaking here. And David sees it, and he picks up on it. Apparently, Joab maybe had talked to him before about it and maybe encouraged him to take him back or something with it, that David can see into the storyline now and see what's going on. And so the woman answers truthfully in verse 19, "As your soul lives, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right or to the left from anything that my lord the king has spoken. Indeed, it was your servant Joab who commanded me, and it was he who put all these words in the mouth of your maidservant. In order to change the appearance of the things, your servant Joab has done this thing. But my Lord is wise like the wisdom of the angel of God to know all that is in the earth." So she admits, yes, this is a plan by Joab to try to bring about reconciliation between you two, and you have seen right through it, and you now understand what is going on. So after hearing the theory of her story, David sees apparently that he kind of fits the same role in regard to Absalom, and he takes it well. So the king said to Joab in verse 21, "Behold now, I will surely do this thing. Go therefore, bring back the young man Absalom." And remember, he's living up over here, quite a ways away. So David takes this matchmaking attempt on the part of Joab well and agrees to bring Absalom back. Joab fell on his face to the ground, prostrated himself, and blessed the king. Then Joab said, "Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, O my lord the king, and that the king has performed the request of his servant." In other words, thank you, David. So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. So he brings him back. However, the king said to him, "Let him turn to his own house and not let him see my face." So Absalom turned to his own house and did not see the king's face. Now there was a chance here for full restitution between these two. But David kind of bungles it. He doesn't let Absalom come into his very presence so that they can kind of make their peace. He lets him come back to Jerusalem, but makes him go to his own house, Absalom's house, and he doesn't come back into David's place. That's not a good move on his part. That only causes further bitterness on the part of Absalom. Joab's plan actually could have worked, or it looks like in theory could have worked and worked well, but David doesn't follow up quite like he should here. He retains a certain amount of animosity toward Absalom and does not welcome him in his presence. Now, Absalom, as it turns out, was a very handsome and impressive guy. There was no one in all Israel as handsome as Absalom. Kind of reminds you of Saul, doesn't it? He was quite the looker too. Foot taller than everybody else. Didn't work out for him though, did it? And so Absalom was highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. He was a likable, attractive young man. The citizenry liked Absalom. And when he cut the hair of his head, and it was at the end of every year that he cut it, he got a haircut once a year whether he needed one or not. It was heavy on him, so he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head, and it weighed 200 shekels by the king's weight, about 3 or 4 pounds. So every year when he cut his hair, it weighed 3 or 4 pounds. It had grown that long. So he had quite long hair, very impressive. And to Absalom there were born 3 sons and one daughter, whose name was Tamar. Apparently he named his daughter after his sister, whose life had been ruined by Amnon. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. So he's got a family of his own, 3 sons and a daughter. Good-looking guy, very impressive, well-liked by the citizenry and public in general of Israel. And so he lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. That's 5 years now he's been gone, 3 years up there in Geshur, and now 2 more years down in Jerusalem. So for 5 years now, David and Absalom have been estranged. So then Absalom sends for Joab to send him to the king. He says, "Joab, get over here and put together a deal to get me in the king's presence." But he would not come to him. That is, Joab would not go to Absalom. So he sent again a second time, but he would not come. Therefore he said to his servants, "See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go set it on fire." So Absalom's servant set the field on fire. Kind of reminds you of Samson, doesn't it? Tying them foxtails together and with torches on them and run them through the Philistines' field and burn them up. This is one way to get Joab to come to him, is to burn up his barley crop. The barley was grown for animals. In the book of Revelation, by the way, when those seals are open, there's a cry that goes out and says, so much money for a loaf of wheat and so much money for a loaf of barley. Well, barley will be, the symbology there is that people will be eating the substances of much lower food value that's normally eaten by animals because of the pestilence and the famine that will result from those wars that break out in the first part of the tribulation period. So barley is a food stock for animals. But people will be eating it during the tribulation period because that's all they're going to be able to get their hands on. So it's a representation of famine in that passage. Well, Joab's got a barley field. He's growing some barley here for his critters, kind of like hay, I suppose, today. And so he figures, well, I'll get Joab over here to talk to him. I'll burn his field up. He'll come over here mad at me, but at least I can talk to him. So they do. They set his field on fire. So Joab arose and came to Absalom at his house and said to him, why have your servants set my field on fire? And Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent for you, saying, come here that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? That is, why did you bring me down to here if I can't see you? It would be better for me to still be there. So I wanted you to work this out between me and David. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face, and there is iniquity in me. Let him put me to death. So he says, look, get me in there, and if he wants to kill me for what has gone on, so be it. So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So after 5 years, he finally gets back in David's presence. Well, you think the relationship has sort of blossomed over the 5 years? No, there's probably some deep-rooted bitterness now between Absalom and David in that he was kind of blown off for 5 years. Two of them most recently when he was nearby. So the situation seems to have improved a tad. It seems to have gotten a little better. But as we'll see as we go on, it isn't really any better at all. It's going to continue to deteriorate. But Absalom, this son of David's, is at least back in Jerusalem, sort of in contact with David on a regular basis. All right, see how this storyline is kind of developing now. One of his sons raped one of David's daughters, and her full-blooded brother took vengeance on him, the rapist, by killing him. So all three of David's children, one is a murderer, one is a dead rapist, and one is a young lady who's had her life totally ruined by her scumbag stepbrother. The family is split up, plotting against each other, not together, not unified, and the overall condition in the realm and in the kingdom is not particularly good in the family of the king. All of this is a result of David's lust for Bathsheba. Remember what James told us in James chapter 1, verse 13 to 15? Remember that storyline? He's telling the people to endure trials and testings and tribulations that God brings into their life for the purpose of strengthening their faith. And then he says, but do not attribute to God the sufferings that you have in your life that are the result of your own lusts. That's your fault. That's your own problem. And when you start that kind of stuff, it can lead to death, James says. So don't think that if you're suffering for a reason that is a result of your own lusts, that that's God working to improve your faith. It is not, he says. That's simply you bringing it about on yourself. And David and his situation here reflects that New Testament principle perfectly well. Old Testament illustrates New Testament principles, and this is being illustrated here. Sin begets sin. Lust got lying, cheating, stealing, murder, death. Now his family's fallen into the same problem. They're experiencing the benefits of lust on the part of Amnon, murder, just like David did to Uriah. Now one of his sons did another one of his sons. All of that stuff is just playing again. All of David's mistakes are being played out in the lives of his family again. Sin begets sin. And as blessed as this guy was, God is exacting a severe penalty from him because of his sins. Fourfold. Two sons are down, two to go. Any question about anything we've seen in this little phase of David's life? If he just turned around and walked away when he saw Bathsheba, things would have been probably so much different and so much better. Like Joseph, flee, leave that coat behind, man, just run away, turn around and run if you have to. But he ran to it. Joseph had the good sense to run from it. And the outcomes are diametrically opposed to one another. Questions or comments? We ain't done. There's more turmoil in the household of David. It'll even extend out after his life's over. Solomon will bring about, will execute a little bit of it himself. So any questions or comments? Okay, cowboy fans. Now, I don't want you to speed. Don't get any tickets. And don't run over anybody. Trying to get home by noon. We'll see you next Sunday, Lord willing.